Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm, and I can hardly stay in my chair. I'm so excited about the show today. I have two guests, Linda Barry and Chris Ware. Linda Barry has a new book called Making Comics, but, you know, you probably have known her for years as the deviser and assembler of Ernie Pook's Comics, and Chris Ware, Jimmy Corrigan, the smartest boy in the world, each book becoming, dare I say it, more complex than the last. Is that an accurate description?
That's very kind of you. That's the aim.
I feel that every time we open a book or a work of art, we should be facing something we may never have seen before.
Yeah.
I agree entirely. Yeah.
Some 30 years ago, Art Spiegelman was led to agree that if we could take frequent breaks, he would come into the studio even though he has to smoke. Back then, it's around 30 years ago, I said, Art, I smoke too. We'll go on breaks together. He said, okay. We did a show, and we became immediate friends. And one by one, he introduced me to Chris Ware's work, to Dan Clowes's work. I think you, Chris, and Dan Clowes, and Chip Kidd, mm-hmm. a book designer, were all on the show together. Now, finally, after years of being told that I would love Linda Barry, that she's inspiring, that she's improvisationally explosive. I have Linda Barry here for her book, Making Comics. And I'm curious about how you all, because Matt Groening, the inventor of The Simpsons, is a part of this, and the Canadian artist named Seth, mm-hmm. is, how did you all get together?
Well, I first met Chris, I remember you being in my mind, you're a kid, and it was when Mouse 2, the second book, had come out, and Art called me on the phone, he was in town to sign books, and he said, I want you to meet this kid. He called you a kid. Mm. I want you to meet this kid. He said, he can draw anything. And I said, oh, okay. He goes, no, I actually mean he can draw anything. And I remember us being in this restaurant or a cafe and that you didn't talk very much and you just sort of kind of leaned back and looked terrified. But I remember I liked you immediately and I didn't know your work and I didn't know what you did, but I just remember liking you immediately. So my relationship with you, Chris, is precedes your work or even precedes me even knowing your work. I just remember you as this very young, sort of timid white boy.
Sadly, very accurate description. Yeah. Well, I knew you before I knew your work too, because I remember seeing you on the David Letterman show when I was in high school. And you were the funniest guest that he'd had. And I thought, like, who is this person? Because your work didn't appear in the Omaha World Herald or any of the Omaha papers at all. But you were a personality that was clearly one to be contended with, and you clearly kind of flipped out the host of the show.
I don't think he knew what I did, honest. I think you could have held a gun to his head and just said, what does she do? And there'd be brains on the other side of the wall because he wouldn't have known.
Well, then when I finally met you with Art, like you're talking about when I was in Chicago, you were the funniest person in person I'd ever. Don't you remember me just laughing at everything you said? It was true. I just sat there and giggled. But Linda's work, when I got to know it, I was not only surprised how funny it was, But in, I guess it was maybe in the mid-80s or so, and in the late 80s where you started to really do serious storytelling in your strips. And it completely knocked me over. I couldn't believe it, the stuff that she was getting at in her stories and strips and how deeply felt it was. I was sure that it was all autobiography because it was drawn with such conviction. And even to say those words, drawn with conviction, didn't really apply to comics at that point. And I was shocked to find out when I think I read an interview in the Comics Journal with you that it was fiction mm-hmm. that you were writing. And I started stealing from you immediately because you had something that I so desperately wanted, which was to be able to write something that felt real and felt like it was emotionally grounded and came from a point that was human, which at that point in comics was almost unheard of. Mm-hmm. And I kind of, from studying your stuff and trying to write stories about my own life, I found myself kind of channeling your voice, but through channeling your voice, finding my own voice.
Yeah. You know who was a big influence for me was Gann Wilson, was Nuts. Hmm.
Wow.
That series he did, Nuts, because
it was in the National Lampoon.
It was the National Lampoon, but it took a childhood sadness seriously. And it really had a big influence on me. Him and Dr. Seuss.
What about
I think.
Peanuts?
You know, oddly, Peanuts, I never ever bonded or attached to Peanuts. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. I think it just was too close to, the sadness was a little bit too close. Hmm. I'm the Family Circus lover.
Yes. Yeah.
Which everybody just, I'm the Family Circus lover. I love Family Circus. But Peanuts was too sad for me. Hmm. Yeah.
Well, what's marvelous is Linda's new book is making comics, and aside from being a marvelous assignment book, which will take you from the childhood activity of drawing monsters all the way up to making comic books, I'm a big fan of her book, 100 Demons. In making comics, she says something that amounts to, if you're uncertain about something, do it again and again and again. And so the first two or three pages of Making Comics is devoted to different versions of 100 Demons. 100 Demons, 100 Demons, 100 Demons. And you see, all together, they make a beautiful gallery and a wonderful collage. And that's what I discovered about Linda Barry, is that her work is a collage of feeling, of vision, of faces, of forms, of animals, of monsters, of demons. Tell the story again and again and again and again, says Gertrude Stein, and you will have told the story. And that's what makes the work, it seems to me, so earnest, funny, but grab you by the scruff of the neck, heart thumping.
I was thinking about how many books I've read for the second, third, or fourth time and had that experience. It's the same book, but I'm seeing something I have never seen before. And which can also have everything to do with three other books you read in between. And suddenly those three other books put this prism and you can see this new kind of color combination. And that's one of the things I love most about books, is kind of how they're endless. And Chris's book, Rusty Brown, is one of those ones that you can dwell in forever.
Starting with Jimmy Corrigan, I started buying the issues, sometimes hardcover, of the Acme Novelty Library.
I love those.
In which pieces of Jimmy Corrigan originally appeared, but pieces after of Rusty Brown. I'm talking to Chris Ware. His new volume is Rusty Brown. And to Linda Barry, her new volume is Making Comics. I don't think you're going to have any trouble finding these books, but Making Comics comes from Drawn and Quarterly, and Rusty Brown comes from Pantheon. Now, what do you each do with the characters that you have in your trunk, who are demons, who are your horribles. In your case, it's the Lint family.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my, when I read Lint on its own volume, I had to recover from the way that these people have been taught. We often wonder, how did people learn to lie, cheat, steal, behave this way toward others? Well, that middle volume will tell you. They're a family, and they are the people who teased me when I was young, who teased me when I was older, who still don't like me, and who've learned to tolerate me at best.
Yeah.
And who get elected.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in Linda's case, I'm not going to name names, but there's the worst boyfriend
mm-hmm.
who called you shallow.
Yes.
And you realized...
Boring and shallow.
Boring and shallow.
Boring and shallow,
but
yes.
You realized that what he said sounded familiar to you, and you realized that he said the kinds of things to you that your mother had said.
And he was wearing, when it happened, he was wearing my bathrobe and had some shampoo on his head to kill lice. So he actually looked just like her when he was saying it. So there was the visual cue as well.
Well, you had come back from the Philippines mm-hmm. where you learned that the word we used to use for people we didn't like, it didn't have to do with lice. We mm-hmm. would say they had cooties.
Cooties.
Mm-hmm. These were people who had cooties who could give you them
mm.
by their meanness, their unkindness, their ungentleness, and... In the Philippines, the Philippine people tell you that cooties, their word is...
Kuto.
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 See, it goes around the world.
Yeah, mm. it really does. Mm. Yeah, kuto. And kuto. There was this whole idea that brown people, Filipino people, had brown kuto, and that there was this theory that white people... had white kuto, which actually turns out to be, there's some truth to that.
Well, eventually, you sent them a picture of the worst boyfriend and said that you'd found the white kuto.
Well, this is the beautiful thing about comics is to be able to, you can, in life, you know, we have things that just upset our boat in a way where the ballast is really just thrown to the wrong end of the ship. And in real life, you can't change what happens. But through either making a comic or reading a comic, these things can be set right again somehow. And that's one of the things I'm interested in what I think is, I just called it the biological function of this thing we call the arts. If one of the basic tenets of evolution is things that tend to contribute to our survival persist, art persists. And so it must have some kind of survival, some survival quality to it. And I know that personally, just being able to right wrongs, even if I fictionalize them, to just make things feel better. Mm-hmm. And when I teach, that's one of the things I talk about. I say, you know, you're talking about editing as if editing is something that's outside of your body, when it's really what we do to make the thing feel right to us. You're not lying exactly. That's what I call autobifictionalography. But it is all about setting something back in balance.
Well, Linda Barry teaches making comics, and this is, I think, the fourth book that talks about how to make pictures, a book called Picture This, a book called What It Is, a book called Syllabus, and now a book called Making Comics, which are done with all kinds of ages, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Some of them are at Wisconsin, Madison University at mm-hmm. Wisconsin, but some of them are 3 and 4 year olds.
Yes, yeah. I just think in a funny way, comics take advantage of the fact, I mean, all they are is a record of how somebody moved their hands, right? Moved their hands over a period of time. And this thing of gesture, particularly gestures of the hands, are some of the oldest language that human beings have. And it starts really, really early. And also recognizing characters happens very, very early.
Well, it's so beautiful to see in these books drawings by children who know instinctively how to draw monsters. Mm-hmm. All you have to say is scary monster. And Kenneth Koch used to do it when he'd teach poetry in the classroom. He'd say, describe a scary monster. Kids know how to do that.
Yeah.
They may not know how to write poetry, but a scary monster?
And it has a poetic quality to it. It, by nature, it will have a poetic quality to it. And that's his genius, really recognizing that poetry isn't something that involves effort. It's almost the opposite.
You know, I mean, kids and adults in the 19th century knew how to draw. They all drew. It was a standard skill. Everybody could watercolor. Everybody, you had to draw. It was the way you apprehended and recorded the world. And that slowly just kind of rolled off now, and it's something that is extinguished in kids somewhere around the age between 8 and 10 or so. My own daughter kept a sketchbook until her third grade teacher told her to not bring it to class anymore. And it was amazing how just that subtle sort of approbation just made her stop. And it's been very hard for her to start. And the thing that frightens me is that, I mean, like, imagine what if all of a sudden people said, you can't talk anymore. That ability would start to erode. And sometimes I worry that's kind of what's happening with people looking at phones all the time.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Linda Barry and Chris Ware. Linda's most recent book is Making Comics, and Chris's is Rusty Brown. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Linda Barry and Chris Ware, authors of Making Comics and Rusty Brown, each of them a vital representative of a vibrant comic culture. Now, I noticed in Rusty Brown, you were writing by the page. Mm-hmm. Stories would end at the bottom of the page. They would continue on the next page, but at a different point in the story. Jump cut. You
right.
continued a few seconds later mm-hmm. with the same scene. And I noticed that although your work is often called methodical and planned out, I think that there's more of Linda Barry's improvisatory impulses mm-hmm. than most people recognize. What yeah. do you say?
I would say, first of all, no, it's not more, it's all. It's everything. Linda's way of writing and thinking and connecting with moments and details of one's past and allowing those things to blossom on the page is the way that I learn to write. And I draw my pictures clearly only so that they're apprehendable and understandable in the same way that I'm pretty sure that we're all sitting at a table right now in a sound studio having a conversation. But later, today or tonight, I'm going to think about it and think, oh my God, why did I say that stupid thing? Or think about something my grandmother said 30 years before, or think about what am I going to be doing in 25 years from now? And that's when things tangle together and become a mess. So it's the story, the clarity of the drawing is only there to allow for the incomprehensibility and tangledness of life to somehow coexist with it.
I, too, will get home and say, how did I say such a stupid thing?
You never do, though.
But I feel that way. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. it's very generous of you, Chris.
You're the only guy doing this, Michael. I can't think of anybody else who talks to writers in a way that every writer wants and hopes that people will
dreams
talk to
of.
Them. Yeah, oh, really, it's true.
You're going to make me blush. I mean, you know, it's pretty when I do, don't worry. But no one can say the right thing at the right time. That's what Rusty Brown is about. All of these different, what other people would call ordinary families, who are not ordinary to themselves, are being looked at by people. They're not ordinary. They're villains. Hmm. But we are not villains. We're ordinary. We haven't been hurt by religious training. We've been endowed with a sense of the sacred. But look at all these ordinary people who are inventing ordinariness as a way of life and then calling it Midwestern. Mm-hmm. And we love them, we hate them, we feel sorry for them, we want to take them in our arms, we want to correct their courses. But in the course of Rusty Brown, what we're looking at is the fact that life does not give us the right things to do and say when we want them and need them.
Yeah.
Oh boy, is this hard, a hard lesson to take in. I'd say as sad as some of Linda Berry's hilarious books are about childhood, well, Chris Ware is going it up a few levels, a few decibels, despair.
Yeah.
Wow, sorry. Well, I'm really not trying to make anybody sad. I'm just trying to write about life as I've experienced it.
You're trying to be accurate,
yeah.
But your accuracy is a truth about life that we've invented all kinds of things in order to avoid, huh?
Yeah, well, that's really true. I mean, that's in a lot of ways, that's like the evil side of culture. That's what the bad thing that culture allows for is to avoid the hardest moments of life, like death and awkward moments and stuff.
Let's make it happy. A fabulous thing has happened. Linda Berry has just won the MacArthur Genius Grant. Well, very recently, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, and it was a total surprise to me. I never thought that I was in the running for anything like that. So it's still, I'm still reeling from it a little bit. But also very, very happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's going to allow me to continue my research with, again, drawing with four-year-olds, working with kids for mutual benefit.
It's so great that you're doing that. I mean, you know, especially when you bring the too young together with the too smart.
That's exactly it. Well, because when I first came to the university, I have a BA from the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington.
Where you studied at the same time with Matt Groening.
Matt Groening and I became very good friends there. But I hadn't been around grad students until I started teaching at the university, and I was really dismayed by how miserable they were and why this was acceptable to the academy. Like, why is it that these people who are at the top of their game physically, mentally, have shown that they're willing to sacrifice to study deeply, their work is what we rely on. Why is this acceptable to the academy that they should be so miserable?
I'm so glad that you just said that, because a lot of people don't know. I had no idea that I could be as unhappy as I was when I was in graduate school.
It's a crime, because that should be those are the people we should be giving every advantage to. And so I started to think, what could I do to sort of ease this unhappiness? And I tried to identify the source. And part of it was that their world had become so narrow, like just a little laser beam. And anything that they were looking at that pertained toward their dissertation or their thesis was valid. Anything else was a waste of time.
Well, Linda, there used to be something that were called achievement tests. So if you wanted to go to graduate school, I took an achievement test in English literature. And putatively, it was testing me on everything I knew, but really it was testing me on everything anthologies knew, everything that was in the Norton anthology.
Right.
They weren't going to ask me about any of my secret loves. At the time, they weren't going to ask me about any gay or minority writers. They were just, you know, give me their Browning. You know,
yeah. Like,
what novel is this a quote from? Vanity Fair.
Yes.
I've never read Vanity Fair. I still haven't. And the thing was that I was so cramped, bent over, I was so stiff at the end of that test that I wrote them a letter and I said, I'm really frightened. This was a test on everything I'm supposed to know. And this is a subject, writing, imaginative literature, that I care about more than anything. And for the first time ever, your test gave me the feeling that it was boring.
Yeah. Mm. There you go. Mm. There you go.
It's kind of school in general. When I went to undergraduate school at the University of Texas, I had this feeling, I've obviously never been to college, I had this feeling where all the teachers just would ask me, what are you going to do next? And then when I got to graduate school, with some exceptions, I felt like the more common question was, why are you doing that? And that's just not a question that should be asked when, you know, that's not, you ask yourself enough questions like that, I think, so.
Well, I'll tell you, I think the answer is, I'm trying to keep my heart alive. I'm trying to keep my joy alive. Mm-hmm. But you've taught me that these are pretentious questions. And if I stand up and roar, I'm trying to keep my soul alive, you're just going to laugh at me. So, you know, that's what we have all done when we get to do what we want to do with our lives. We keep our joy, we keep our heart, we keep our soul. And that's what my two guests, Linda Barry and Chris Ware, have been able to do, and to do it for you, to show you how in their books. Everyone, keep listening for these next weeks, because you're going to hear separate interviews with Linda Barry and with Chris Ware. This was my time to have a coffee crotch.
A hen party.
I've been talking with Linda Barry and Chris Ware, authors of, respectively, Making Comics and Rusty Brown, published by, respectively, Drawn and Quarterly and Pantheon. I'm thrilled to have you with me. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show. Also available at Apple, Spotify, and all podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's own smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Jeanette Winterson is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.